Welcome to Changemakers Without Borders. I'm your host, Mike Cooper. This show is broadcast on CKMS, Radio Waterloo in Ontario, and CFUZ, Peach City Radio in British Columbia. You can also find this show on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts. In this episode, called Photo 51, The DNA Lady, I delve into the woman who was behind the discovery of the double helix, behind the rapid Nobel Prize that was awarded to Francis Crick and James Watson. I would love to hear from you. Write to me at changemakerswithoutborders@gmail.com for any questions or comments, and I hope you enjoy part one of Photo 51. In the middle of a cold Swedish winter, on December 10th, 1962, a great hall in the capital bustled with activity. People wearing their most luxurious evening clothes listened to the best musicians on the grand stage as they glided their bows across their taut strings, making their notes ring like bells in a cathedral. Attendants from all over the world were trying to catch an early glimpse of the crème de la crème, world leaders in the highest reaches of intellect who would become the forefathers for humanity's most important advancements. Hundreds of people stood up from their seats as the lecturer announced the names of the Nobel Prize winners, the thundering claps that followed, and the speeches. At last, they heard the names they were waiting for. James Dewey Watson, Francis Harry Compton Crick, and Morris Hugh Frederick Wilkins for discovering deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, a molecule responsible for our appearance, our lineage, some say even half of our intellect, and for filling countless lecture halls about its mysteriousness and wonder. When the three received their prize, they made no mention of a certain key person who now lay in the grave as they spoke, a person who was responsible for a large portion of the DNA discovery. That person was a brilliant scientist who had a keen eye for accuracy, as well as enthusiasm for the advancement of science. She was a woman whose work on the subject of molecular biology and chemistry gave a stronger foundation for what Watson and Crick later continued. As the occupants of the hall praised these scientists, they didn't know they were perpetuating a false history that would remain under wraps for decades. James Watson, still alive today at 92 years old, dragged another scientist's name through the muck despite him not being able to make it to the finish line without her, without Rosalind Franklin. He even admitted it, although not with pride. He put it in an article's footnotes, a year after their work, quote-unquote, was published. In the footnotes, Watson and Crick said that, without King's College, whom Rosalind Franklin worked under, the formulation of our structure would have been most unlikely, if not impossible. Although co-winner Francis Crick sent Watson a 6-page letter to dissuade him from publishing the double helix a few years after the Nobel Prize because of its biased approach and the way it projected a pretty derogatory picture of the woman who really unflinchingly helped his team at Cambridge despite them being her competitors, he and the other Nobel laureates did not mention her in their acceptance speeches, and she did not appear anywhere in his footnotes either. In the double helix, a book published years after Rosalind Franklin was safely in her grave. Watson reveals how they all called her Rosie behind her back, and claims that she has a bossy attitude and would have looked better if she'd done something novel with her hair. Throughout his book, he treats the other scientists, either working with him or competing against him, with full respect by writing their full names every time he talks about them, but not with Rosalind Franklin. Despite this, and perhaps because of this, Rosalind became quite famous. She was turned into an evil caricature that interfered with and tried to prevent the discovery. Roland Gosling, Franklin's lab assistant, said after their first meeting that she had beautiful dark eyes, shining black hair, an intensity about her, and an awkwardness in conversation. In textbooks, college study books, or personal accounts about the subject of DNA or the discovery of DNA in general, there will probably be only 2 out of 10 of them that will mention Rosalind Franklin, and that will be in passing. From 1949 to 1953, Rosalind Franklin and her lab partner Roland Gosling at King's College worked towards the unknown structure of DNA. Before then, John T. Randall, both Franklin's and Wilkins' supervisor, wrote to Rosalind a small note that would forever be at fault for creating what would become one of the greatest rivalries in scientific lab history, and a contributing factor to the hurtful situation that was created in the lab and in the world. In the note, J.T. Randall wrote to the then-already Ph.D. Rosalind that she will be working on the DNA structure with assistant Ryan Gosling, and that Morris Wilkins, will be working on a different research project. It seems to be that Morris Wilkins was under the impression that she would become his assistant, although things about this are not 100% clear. Wilkins had actually suggested Randall in the first place to let Franklin work on the DNA structure, since he was working on proteins. In the double helix, James Watson writes, "Morris, a beginner in X-ray diffraction work, wanted some professional help and hoped that Rosie, a trained crystallographer, could speed up his research. Rosie, however, did not see the situation this way. She claimed that she had been given DNA for her own problem and would not think of herself as Morris's assistant." But then he goes on to say, "Clearly, Rosie had to go or be put in her place. The former was obviously preferable, because, given her belligerent moods, it would be very difficult for Morris to maintain a dominant position that would allow him to think unhindered about DNA." End quote. Once, Watson and Crick invited her and Wilkins to come and see the model they had created for the DNA structure in the Cavendish at Cambridge. Without blinking an eye, or even thinking about credit or competition, she explained to her rival university lab scientists about the major problems in their model. They had their DNA strands in the middle of the structure, and their base pairs on the outside, the complete opposite of reality. In a way, their model looked more like a tree with those shelf mushrooms growing on its bark, where the true one needed to look more like an interconnected spiderweb held inside a spiral. Perhaps I'll give us a bit more imagery on how the DNA actually looks like. It has 2 ribbon-like strands from either side that coil around each other, which makes it look like a spiral or a double helix. These strands act like a backbone to rod-like nitrogenous base pairs. These rods meet in the middle and connect between the 2 strands. Franklin had the necessary knowledge in biochemistry and mathematics to be able to make this hypothesis, knowledge that the two fellow Cambridgers lacked in. From looking at her unpublished material, without her knowledge, and garnering the information she gave in her lectures and in her feedback, they were able to make a leap of faith about the structure without the mathematical backing in the beginning. That Rosalind Franklin had. In fact, she was very close to reaching the correct structure herself, but she hadn't wanted to publish her findings until she had found complete proof. To strengthen the reason she did this is illustrated in what Francis Crick later said. Quote, "I'm afraid we always used to adopt, let's say, a patronizing attitude towards her." End quote. Here's an excerpt of an interview with James Watson and Francis Crick, where Crick talks about the way that they treated Rosalind with fairness.
But the question at the heart of that has to be answered is whether it's in fact true that she had a bad career in science.
No, I don't think she did, because she went on and did very good work on tobacco mosaic virus. And remember, she did die young, and she would have done very, very much more. And I never noticed at any period in my dealings with her, or other people's dealings with her, that she was handicapped, because in scientific work, as maybe a few such minor social things, as a woman, we certainly accepted her as just another scientist.
After seeing her astonishing progress, it seems that Wilkins, Watson, Crick, and even her supervisor, J.T. Randall himself, a contributor to Second World War technological advancements, began to feel threatened. At this time, it was already quite unbearable for Rosalind Franklin to stay in the lab with the antagonism between her and Wilkins. On April 17th, 1953, 4 years after she joined King's College, he wrote to her, demanding that she will stop the DNA research and stop teaching Gosling. "Dear Miss Franklin, you will no doubt remember that when we discussed the question of your leaving my laboratory, you agreed that it would be much better for you to cease to work on the nucleic acid problem and take up something else. I appreciate that it is difficult to stop thinking immediately about a subject on which you have been so deeply engaged. But I should be grateful if you could now clear up, or write up, the work to the appropriate stage. A very real point about which I am a little troubled is that it is obviously not right that Gosling should be supervised by someone not specifically resident in this laboratory. You will realize that the necessary reorganization for this purpose, which arises from your departure, cannot really proceed while you remain, in an intellectual sense, a member of the laboratory. Yours sincerely, J.T. Randall." Signed. Some say that Morris Wilkins became quite irritated when he understood that his new lab inhabitants at King's College had actually made adjustments to the equipment. Some say he was even half in love with Rosalind Franklin. He would get flustered when she spoke to him directly and would never really meet her eyes, always taking off his glasses when they spoke, and always mumbled his answers. Rosalind had to work on improving the machinery in the lab herself so that she'd be able to get the accuracy she needed to take the photographs of the DNA molecule.
With one light on and one room, I know you're up when I get home. With one small step upon the stair, I know your look when I get there. If you were a king up there on your throne, would you be wise enough to let me go? For this queen you think you are wants to be a hunter again. I want to see the
J.D. Bernal, a crystallographer and pioneer in the field, said after her passing that Franklin took some of the most beautiful X-ray diffraction photos ever made. She was an excellent student from the beginning of her lifetime. In her youth, she was sent to an all-girls boarding school that believed in women having careers as well as families. It was called St. Paul's, though it wasn't religious. She always maintained top marks and was one of the best students the private school had ever seen. She received a scholarship from St. Paul's that would have paid for at least 3 years of her studies at Cambridge. But her father suggested her to give it to a student in need, so she gave it to a refugee for their own studies. She was always athletic and went with her family on hikes since a very young age. When she became older, she would take long hikes in the Himalayan mountains with lifelong friends of hers from St. Paul's and the university in France. One of her friends, named Jean Kerslake, whom she went traveling with to most of Europe, said that Rosalind was in better shape than most of them, and would many times still be well and good to continue after a 12- or 16-hour hike. Another friend from St. Paul's later worked in the top-secret government Bletchley Park project to help crack the German encryption machine, the Enigma. Rosalind Elsie Franklin was born on July 29th, 1920, to a well-established family of seventh-generation British Jews. In 1926, on one of the Franklins' holidays, her childless aunt, Mammy Bentwich, joined them for a bit and wrote home of her sister's children to her husband, the Attorney General. She spoke about all of the children's charm, but took note of Rosalind's abilities with her mind. She said that Rosalind was alarmingly clever and spent all of her time doing arithmetic for pleasure. She always got her answers right. Alarming would be a fitting word in those days. High female intellect was considered an embarrassment more times than not. If women did pursue careers, it was mostly accepted that they would put their careers completely aside when they would start a family. The Franklin women were educated. They went to London universities and received diplomas and sat on different educational committees and associations. At the Working Men's College Annual Bazaar, a great event at an institution her father, Ellis Franklin, supported immensely, Rosalind was chosen at 3 years old to present a bouquet of flowers to a dignified woman who gave kind words to the 80 volunteer teachers and the 1,000 new students there. This woman, then the Duchess of York, later became Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. We'll now hear an excerpt of James Watson speaking about Rosalind Franklin in a TED Talk in California called How We Discovered DNA. There he entertains a crowd of hundreds of people with false information about how she was just a crystallographer, but not a chemist.
Rosalind Franklin was leaving in about 2 months, and after she left, he would start building models. And so I came back with that news to Cambridge, and Bragg said, build models. Or, of course, I wanted to build models. And there was a picture of Rosalind. She really, you know, in one sense she was a chemist, but really she would have been trained, she didn't know any organic chemistry or quantum chemistry. She was a crystallographer. Never build nest like coming.
child in the sun.
And I think part of the reason she didn't want to build models is she wasn't a chemist, whereas Pauline was a chemist. And so Crick and I started building models, and I learned a little chemistry, but not enough. Well, we got the answer on 28th of February, 53, and it was because of a rule, which to me is a very good rule, never be the brightest person in the room. And we weren't.
A little bit from the cold air, a little bit of you not too old with this, a little bit of love song from another STD. So keep you warm and a little bit of cold about thorning up, a little bit of tone ever whisper there.
Rosalind Franklin made breakthroughs in three major fields of study, which helped the world fight both disease and death, and understand the reason for life and how it's created on Earth, down to our very atoms. She significantly improved air filtration for soldiers in the war, created a strong foundation for virus research used till this day, and did painstakingly accurate work on the source for the human genome that cost her her own life at the end, at a very early age. Rosalind used a liquid crystal lattice formula underneath the microscope. The microscope would take X-ray images of the sample and took 100 hours to produce each photo. Today, an image like this would take 5 minutes, and that includes a computer-generated skeleton structure of the DNA molecule that Rosalind had to draw out by hand herself. Being at such high exposure to X-ray radiation, there were a number of safety precautions that a lot of the lab mates felt were tiring and unnecessary. In those days, standard lab practices involved high-risk procedures that today would be completely unacceptable. But each of them did go for periodic checks to, see if the radiation levels in their body were reaching the limit. Rosalind felt disgruntled when she was asked to take a break from the lab for 2 to 3 weeks when she had reached the safety limits, but she would take the opportunity to go for those long hikes and meet family and friends. There is a myth that her father was against her higher education, but on the contrary, he just wanted her to join the British military against the ruthless Nazi power that was threatening to tear apart democracy in the 20th century. In a letter to her father, she explained that she was willing to, but preferred to be in the lab to try to find a way to defeat Hitler through science. She didn't want to be stuck in the shipbuilding facilities, where she knew she would become bored quite quickly. But she was disappointed when J.T. Randall, her lab supervisor at King's College, gave her assignments that were not connected to that vision. She grew frustrated when she saw male colleagues working right beside her, taking on subjects that were in line with her loyalty to her family and to Britain.
I look at you all, see the love that's sleeping, while my guitar gently weeps. I look at the floor and I see it needs sweeping, still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told you how to unfold your love. I don't know how.
When she was in Newnham College, a women's university that belonged to Cambridge, she was present in a lecture by Adrienne Ouveille, a strong, vivacious French-Jewish pupil of Marie Curie. It is clear that Rosalind was not a feminist, for she wrote to her father of the lecture, "Very good, though female." It was the reality of the day that even educated women didn't have the same access to good education as men. Veje not only became her inspiration, but a good friend that helped her receive her PhD by connecting her to France. Rosalind did her work on carbons with supervisor Jacques Mering, a world-renowned scientist excellent in crystallography, the art of taking X-ray diffraction pictures of molecules, a skill she later used extensively in her work on DNA. He was a handsome, middle-aged, brilliant man who immediately recognized a genius in Rosalind Franklin and would stay up very late in the evening to debate science with her. But he was also known to be a womanizer, despite him being married. The tension he created between himself and Rosalind was strong, strong enough for people to believe that something physical had actually transpired. But that was not the case, according to Rosalind's family after her death. When she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer at the age of 37, she wasn't able to walk and was hospitalized for a long time. Even on her bed, she continued to make calculations and did her best to continue the research on the TMV virus, the tobacco mosaic virus that she was working on with Aaron Klug, who later received a Nobel for their joint work after she died, and made sure to mention her. In fact, Rosalind gave Klug most of her inheritance so that he'd be able to stay in Britain with his wife and his young son instead of being sent back to South Africa, his home country. We'll now hear an excerpt from Aaron Klug, who talks about her.
We now know what Rosalind didn't know, that they had seen the MRC report in 1952. But to this day, I don't know whether how much she knew of what they... She must have suspected that Crick and Watson must have known a good deal about her work, but none of it was published other than the MRC report. But I don't know that she knew that they had read this report. But Rosa never complained. I never heard her complain or whinge or anything about it. I think she regarded herself as in fact, she admired them enormously, both of them.
You are listening to Changemakers Without Borders. I'm your host, Mai Cooper, and we heard part one of Photo 51, The DNA Lady, which takes us through Rosalind Franklin's journey as a female scientist in World War II and the discovery of the DNA structure that cost her her own life at the end. If you'd like to write to me any comments or questions, I'd love to hear from you. Send them to changemakerswithoutborders@gmail.com. Again, that's changemakerswithoutborders@gmail.com. changemakers without borders at gmail.com. Changemakers Without Borders will air every Wednesday from 8 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. EST on Radio Waterloo CKMS. Peach City Radio CFUZ broadcast times will be announced soon. Thanks again.